You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Ali Leroy. Ali, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hey, I'm glad to be here, man.
Ali, you've had a pretty amazing history. We could talk about a lot of your work, but to begin with, I want to talk about your film of last year, The Obituary of Tunde Johnson, but also, what are you working on right now? What's happening at the moment? If I imagine it's more than one thing, but what's on your plate at the moment?
Well, you know, unfortunately, the pandemic has put a lot of things on pause or slowed a lot of things down, but one of the shows I recently sold was called The Honorable, which I sold to CBS with a writing partner of mine, Michelle Amore. And we're waiting to, you know, to get that into conversations with the studio and the network about seeing when we can go to pilot on it. So fingers crossed on that, but things are looking good there. And, you know, I'm just in my regular development process with, you know, a few different studios, literally about two or three different projects in the works. But right now, the Honorable is the one that I'm most excited about. We're really looking forward to seeing if we can make that happen.
And does that relate to the film, which I also want to talk about, The Obituary of Tunde Johnson?
No. So The Honorable came about after myself and Michelle had a number of conversations about politics in Chicago. I'm from Chicago. She's from Chicago. And in the last mayoral election, when Lori Lightfoot was running, there was just this whole crazy, you know, campaign period, and I just happened to be in Chicago during that time, and just got really fascinated, you know, and I've always been fascinated by Chicago politics, but this was just another one of those big major turning points. And so this show that we crafted about a black woman becoming the mayor of Chicago is where all of that kind of stemmed from. And I mean, we're kind of prescient, I think, because, you know, I mean, ultimately Lori won, and then a lot of women, black women in particular, have also been rising up in, you know, political ranks, not just locally, but nationally. You know, there's a lot of women that you just, you know, weren't aware of before who are making, like, you know, incredible, you know, and significant changes and progress in politics and society. So, you know, we really wanted to just do something that spoke to, you know, black women's impact, you know, in society, and also, you know, like the dual, you know, responsibilities of holding office and then, you know, literally having all the pressures and responsibilities of being an active partner in the home and, you know, raising children and being a partner to a spouse, all these kind of things that, you know, I think are not uniquely women's experience, but I would dare say predominantly women's experiences, trying to juggle all of that and being a black woman doing it, I think, you know, is like a, you know, it's like a high wire act. So we really wanted to kind of speak to that and get the fun and excitement of just exploring a character like that and that type of story. So we're excited.
Well, like you're saying, it is prescient, it is timely, it's part of the conversation that's happening now. I mean, that fits into a number of things, but it seems that we're going through incredible awakenings in some way, or maybe that's not quite the right word, but there's a number of issues that are on the table around women, around being black, around so many issues that seem very important and that were previously fairly difficult to discuss, right, in terms of movies, books, anything. There wasn't really a receptive audience for example.
I mean, a couple of things happened, I think, is, you know, unfortunately, left to our own devices, you know, I think people in general tend to maintain the status quo, whatever it is. You know, they do what works. And then there's always an element on the fringes that I think has a more expanded view of how we could live, how we'd like to live, how we should be able to live, and is not really caught up deep in the muck of just keeping the machine going. And so, you know, every now and again, I think society and people in general need major disruptions to force them to deal with things that are ever present, ongoing, and need to be addressed. And like I said, it's just like, you know, until something festers and bursts, you know, in the society, people are willing to just, you know, put a thumb in the dam, so to speak, until that just can't work anymore. And then they deal with it when they have to deal with it. You know, it's not the pandemic or anything else. You know, Bill Gates, Obama, these guys were talking about a global pandemic years ago and saying that is a great possibility. They had a trial run with H1N1, and then the headliner showed up.
Right.
It's like, oh boy. That was the opening act.
Yeah.
And so,
reality TV is like that, right? Reality yes. TV is usually set up that way.
And whether it's creatively, and you know, you use it as a metaphor for everything we do, but you know, even for myself in entertainment, creating material for an increasingly diminishing group of people, you know, is a tough way to go about, you know, maintaining a business model when you have all of these other sectors of society rising up who would like to be entertained as well. You know, and it's specifically in the case of black women are an incredibly dedicated and reliable audience. And the idea that show business in general, up until the last couple of years, hasn't really had a huge effort devoted to maintaining, you know, a connection with this audience is absurd. It's not different from children's programming. You know, you always know there's going to be more kids, so you keep making kids shows. Like,
right.
It's not a bad business to be in.
Right.
Like, I make TV. Oh, no, there's going to be some more kids showing up. They'll be here in a minute. So, and it's the same
right.
thing, you know. Unfortunately for black women, they have a unique space in a society where, you know, there's a great deal of underrepresentation. And then also, you know, the choices of how you go about enjoying a life. You know, unfortunately, a lot of black women don't have, you know, long-term partnerships in terms of, you know, casual romance, or certainly not in terms of marriage. So there's a lot of camaraderie, you know, in that space. So black women tend to do things in groups together. And, you know, if you can speak to that audience, you know, it's a great thing to do. And if you're not trying, you might be kind of dumb. So,
it took a long time for that to really take hold, right? I mean, that seems so obvious as you're saying it, but yet the industry, you're saying, wasn't set up that way or thinking that way until very recently.
Right. Well, because even when, over the years, like the literary material that tended to be, you know, made into films was material that was coming from black women, right? It was, you know, it was The Color Purple, it was Terry McMillan, you know, and just a host of other works and writers. And I mean, certainly we've got some James Baldwin in there now and some August Wilson, but a lot of times the material that was making it to the screens in terms of adaptations, what I was aware of was largely, you know, coming from a lot of times female authors, female creatives, and those were the things that were making it, that were turning into movies that worked, that people were excited about, and that certainly the women were showing up for. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be doing the rest of this work, but it definitely says this is something that maybe you should be paying attention to this. We don't all have to do the same things. You know, we can't all do the same things, but it is important to have some respect for, you know, the different, audiences that are there to, you know, to take advantage of or, you know, to avail yourself of, so to speak.
And let's talk about the audience for your film of last year, The Obituary of Tunde Johnson. Yeah, can you tell me a little bit about that? Because this is, of course, a film we could really talk quite a lot about in terms of how it's
yeah.
taken the time, but also the context of what you're saying. So maybe we should start with, who did you think the audience was for this film, or is?
Well, so, you know, the writer Stanley Kalu, you know, he's just really an incredible talent. So, you know, Stanley's young. He's African. And when he wrote this script, I think he was 18 or 19 years old. And he was fresh to America from, you know, an upbringing in Africa, Nigeria, Kenyan, different areas, across the continent. So when he came to America, one of the things he said was the first thing that happened to him was that he was black. See, because in Africa, he was an African, right? And more specifically, right. a Nigerian. But in America, he just suddenly became black, right? And then, you know, landing under this catch-all term for an entire group of people who are, in fact, not a monolith, you know, and then, you know, he's watching the news and seeing these cycles of violence. So the genesis of this, you know, if I can speak for him, was not an attempt to speak to someone, but more about something that he was experiencing. And I've always kind of said this because my roots are in stand-up. So, you know, I did stand-up comedy for, you know, a number of years, you know, back in the day. And what I always believed right. is if I told a joke and I thought it was funny, then I figure at least a million other people think this is funny. At least. There's 300 million people in the country. I think a million of them might think this is funny. My goal is to try to find those million people and get a dollar from everybody. but what I mean by that is so this film speaks to, I think, a young demographic who is having expanded and challenged ideas around identity, acceptance, and what type of treatment, you know, they're experiencing in this society. And it's very intersectional, you know, so you're dealing with issues of immigration or you know, an immigrant experience. You're also dealing with the realities of simply being black in America, and then you're also dealing with the issues of other identity. You know, this kid identifies as gay and so on and so forth. So, you know, it's speaking to these people who are having these intersectional experiences but still find themselves somehow at the perimeter of understanding as opposed to at the center of it. Right?
Like thematically, as for example, Ta-Nehisi Coates's book Between the World and Me, this kind of
right.
like what does it mean to be a black body in
right.
in the United States?
Right, exactly. And so that idea of what that means and how, you know, how you're challenged around it. And there's a thing that was very special to me in terms of trying to address on the violence against black bodies idea. Is that it also speaks to respectability politics. You know, there's this idea that has been floated around for, you know, for the ages, that if we only behaved, you know, this way, if we wore this type of outfit or said words in this fashion or ate at these places or lived in this neighborhood, then you would be all right, you know. But you can't assimilate
your... If someone who's a black body, you mean, did?
Right. If black people of color, if other gendered...
Right,
if
just
anybody
acted
who
differently, did something.
Right. If anybody that did not adhere to a white, heterosexual, male-defined norm, right?
Right.
It's like, if only those people would do more things that we like them to do, then they would be okay. And it's like,
right.
how'd you get to decide?
Well, if only they weren't themselves.
Right. If only they were not them, they would be fine. And I mean, I'm laughing, but that's a horrible way to have to exist because, you know, the people who are putting that pressure and that stress and creating that reality that fuels outright violence all the way down to microaggressions, you know, does it have to exist in that space? And the Chinese water torture of it all, that it's just been going on for so long, you know, it needs some attention, you know, and not just understanding. I think people understand it. I just think that there's been some reticence to deal with it. And again, just one more idea about, you know, operating in that space. You know, in this film, you know, there are a variety of ways that we demonstrate that it doesn't make any difference what you do. You know, acceptance of who you are, you know, cannot be forced on someone else with their ever-moving goalposts. If they don't have the capacity to engage with their own humanity and allow for other people to simply be, then there's almost nothing you can do other than try to put a stop to those types of people being in control of the populace. You know, we're seeing that with our elections, right? It's that idea. You don't have to like me, but I also don't have to let you be in charge.
So, right.
But I
like that it's not about something that you can do, right? Because this moment is being relived throughout
yeah.
this film, and it's that there isn't we maybe that is a human kind of idea that we think, oh, we could have done something differently, right? I mean, that happens. To prevent what was clearly something that we had no control over, but we think maybe we could have done it differently or something.
Right.
I remember I just recently read a Primo Levi book where he was talking about, he's a Holocaust survivor, and he says invariably I teach, I go to elementary school, I tell them my story, and one kid comes up to me and says, next time if this happens again to you, get out this way, crawl under the fence, you know, dig a hole here.
Right.
This idea of, there was probably another way out and you didn't take it. There was something different you could have done.
Right.
Which is disturbing, you know, but seems innocent enough for coming from a kid, but you know, of course it's a complete miss.
Right. Well, you know, but that's fine. A child's understanding of how to solve a problem is fine. Children aren't in charge.
Right.
But when a grown person says to you, well, why don't you just dig a hole and get out from under? No. How about we stop the crazy guy? How about we do that? You know, and I want to be careful here just because of I know it's a multifaceted understanding, but the reality of even saying Al-Qaeda and an Osama bin Laden is, okay, you know, we have some substantive disagreements, and you might feel wronged, and that might be a legitimate wrong. You know, what you're upset about with me might deserve, you know, a real sit-down and try to figure out how we're going to work this out. But when you start flying planes into buildings, now we just got to stop you.
Right, you
have to be stopped, and then we'll talk to the next guy. But and so it's like that, you know. Sometimes the clear and present danger is such that it has to be dealt with, you know, in a substantive and decisive fashion. And that doesn't necessarily mean violence, but it does mean a collective, you know, responsibility towards ending, you know, oppression and violence and discrimination, you know, against people who are powerless or who have less power. And, you know, Tunde speaks to a lot of those ideas, not just in terms of the violence itself, but, you know, how we express ourselves, what words do we use, how do we, you know, how do we interact in the space of ideas? Are we capable of listening to one another and understanding one another, or do we simply get entrenched in our collective, you know, fear-filled bubbles and just, you know, hope that the other guys go down before we do? So I don't know. It's complex, and, you know, this film certainly speaks to some of those things, but the goal, and again, where it genuinely came from, is Stanley's experience of coming from Africa as a young man to America and seeing something in a way that he had not seen it, and experiencing something in a fashion that also is kind of, you know, unfamiliar to Americans. Like as a black man in America, you know, I've just always been black. I have no idea what it means to be or feel African and to have a connection to a history and an idea and an experience and a place that I could go to and go, I'm one of you guys.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I belong
right.
here. I'm absolutely one of you guys. They go, yeah, as a matter of fact, you are. So come on in. So I don't know, man. It's complex. You know, we try to deal with some of these things through entertainment and art and, you know, and discourse and what have you. So
here we are. This film, though, of course, is you know, it's not comedy. This is a very serious issue and painful issues that we're talking about. This is a very different kind of conversation and work for you too, right? And maybe a different direction in your work. We're talking about social justice and change and very difficult ideas like you're talking about now. Do you feel that this film did bring up some, what was the conversation after this film? Was there any surprising reactions to it or reactions that you thought were right on? I mean, how was it received? It was, of course, received very well terms of winning awards. But how did you feel the conversation was around it? Was it sharing something? Because that is such a unique perspective by the writer, but it shed light on so many other issues, being the other in all kinds of ways. How did you feel about the conversation that was started from that? Was there anything that surprised you or was particularly interesting in terms of what people said in response to the film?
Well, there have been a couple of instances where people who have seen the film, and this is at screenings, where I and myself and Stanley have spoken to people like literally right after a screening. And we have had, all the reactions from, an incredible amount of support around this being a type of story that needs to be told. You know, we've had young people, I'm saying young people, but Stanley's only 23. So he's one of them. But in my case, young people coming up saying that they know this life. You know, it's not because the young people, what they don't do is while the violence is a heightened part of the storytelling, the essence of what the story is really about is this is a tragic love story about a kid trying to find out, who he is for himself and then, by extension, who he belongs with, like who's good for him, right? And so that resonates with young people in an incredible way as they're moving into this space of stepping into the world and getting into relationships and determining what their worth is and who they can love and who they can be loved by, and then what do they do when that doesn't go well, right? Mm. So that part of the story, which I think is sort of unflinching, speaks to a lot of young people and certainly, Nicola, who played Marley in the film, and Spencer, who played Soren, as well as, of course, Steven Silver, who portrays Tunde, have all had, just really in-depth conversations about what it means to be a young person coming of age in this incredibly shifting, and complicated space. So that's part of it. And then one of the most impactful conversations I had when we screened at the Austin Film Festival, middle-aged white guy, I'm going to assume he was probably in his 40s, stood up after this film during the Q&A and was like, I'm looking at this film, it touches me deeply. And literally the man is like, he's holding back tears and he's going, like, what can I do to make a difference? And what I said to him was like, well, you're doing it right now. Like, you're sitting in the space with a group of people who you don't necessarily have so much in common with, and you're opening yourself up to listening about their experience. Like, dude, if everybody could do that, that would be amazing. That would be amazing if instead of telling you that you aren't going through what you're actually going through, and how people perceive themselves and their difficulties, that has everything to do with where you're sitting. So, what might be difficult for you might not be so difficult for me, but you can't use my way of solving your problem because you don't have my resources. You don't have my state of mind. You don't have my experience. So, you may not be able to do what I think is an easy enough thing to do. And just understanding that I don't want to have the life that I'm having be as difficult as it is, but I also don't necessarily know, how to make it stop.
that's so interesting and points to something, kind of complex that I've struggled with. I mean, I remember after reading, Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, and then The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin, they seem to be such different images of answers to that question that man was asking, what,
right.
And the way I am kind of paraphrasing the difference between both those books is it seemed to me Ta-Nehisi Coates is saying, no, what he's saying in The Fire Next Time isn't what James Baldwin was saying, isn't the case that when white people understand, how blacks have suffered, that we will come together. as I understood it, Ta-Nehisi Coates was saying, they will never understand. It's impossible they're not a black body. They could be sympathetic in some way, but it has, he was sort of saying, like, the two will never meet. It's impossible. What do you think about that? That was hard for me to kind of swallow and think.
You're dealing with a couple of different perspectives, and, you know, two things to consider are, one, you know, James Baldwin is at his, you know, height as a voice, you know, in the 60s, you know, so this is a man whose experiences and perspectives and ideas, you know, came to their height in the late 60s. So now you're 50 years later, and Ta-Nehisi Coates is looking not just at the experiences that he's having, but, you know, you have, you know, 50 years of new information. You know, it's almost like when they do lab experiments, they need a control, right? It's like, what's the one thing that's consistent so that we can tell what's different? And so, you know, in this societal experiment, you know, the things that James Baldwin is talking about in the 60s, you know, well, for Ta-Nehisi Coates, it's like, what's the same? What's different? What ideas can we dispense as ones that don't work? What ideas did we negate that should be explored? And then what is this sort of cumulative impact that, you know, society is having? And then you're also dealing with black men who have two incredibly dramatically different experiences. Ta-Nehisi Coates is a father, right?
Right.
He's a married man. He's got a father. You know, he's a father, so he's writing about an experience not just that he has had as a black man with precedents that he's been able to see in the space of King and Baldwin and, you know, and Malcolm X and whatever other, you know, black luminaries there are that sort of informed what he thought, versus Baldwin, who is a gay man, you know, in the 60s, who is, you know, not just dealing with racism, but the idea of identity wasn't even something that was being discussed. Right.
It's like that wasn't even on the table. Like
it's not even on the
sexual,
table.
Sexual politics in the 60s, as much as we'd like to say it was, really wasn't on the table. There was no gay rights or trans or anything like that. Yeah.
So James Baldwin is being he's speaking to this experience, you know, largely as an intellectual. Right. Like, his ideas are being framed around these sort of philosophical and irrefutable ideas that don't have anything to do necessarily with me being black. They are, but the construct of how I'm talking about the treatment is something that's more universal, right? As opposed, and Coates is really coming at it from the space of, okay, let's forget about, you know, he's like, it's almost like James Baldwin is All Lives Matter, right? And it's like, I'm using the construct of humanity to speak to these ills that exist in our society. And so then later, you know, 50 years later, you go, okay, that All Lives Matter thing didn't work. Let's go with Black Lives Matter. Like, literally that. We were at All Lives Matter. All men are created equal. We were going on what you said.
Right,
you said this. I didn't write the Constitution. You wrote it, and then you said all men are created equal. Turns out that wasn't the truth. Or at least all men aren't treated equal. We may have been created equal, but we are not treated equally. You know?
Right.
And then Colt comes along and goes, okay, forget about clearly the things that you people say about this imaginary society that you think you want to live in. That doesn't apply, so let's talk about this now. Let's talk about what you've been doing. I've got 50 years of hope behind me that says you're not coming around. So now I got to make a new. I got to do something new because you're not, you know, you're not living up to your own promise. So I have to change, and that's where Coates is, I believe, versus, you know, Baldwin versus Garvey. You know, Garvey was like,
right,
let's get the hell out of here. Let's get the hell out of here.
Or maybe another voice worth talking about in this context, because it also perhaps relates to the film, is Jeremy O. Harris, right, talking about being queer and black, and is also a writer that seems to be almost in the vein of James Baldwin, you know. But like you said, it's 50 years later. Now he's making jokes about being queer all the time and calling out people in a whole variety of ways on whatever, Twitter and other things.
Right.
And that's a different kind of a voice that hasn't been heard either, it seems, which your film is also pointing towards a little bit, because we're talking about a gay character, right?
Right. So the thing I think is helpful is that these lines that have been drawn in the sand between these groups of othered individuals. And when I say other, I'm suggesting that straight white men, you know, have sort of established themselves as this societal default. So that excludes, you know, white women, straight and or gay, and however gendered, you know, and sexual you identify. That excludes, you know, all the other ethnicities and, of course, you know, black women and black men. So when we start talking about equality and humanity, you know, now suddenly, you know, black people have been screaming about this stuff, you know, from the rafters for, I don't know, what, a couple of hundred years? Mm-hmm. And so now suddenly, you know, 2 years ago, white women all of a sudden, you know, it's been like 100 years since they had any issues that they felt were substantive enough to pour into the streets. And so now, you know, white women are like, hey, what about us? And then, like, and then the LGBTQIA plus.
Right.
Like it keeps expanding. and unfortunately, you know, even though there are all of these delineations inside, you know, that community, it's being treated as a collective, not unlike black people. Right? So now you're just all in the LGBTQ. It's like, I don't know how many of you guys there are. There's a bunch of y'all. Y'all all doing different stuff. But what's the same is that it's not the same stuff as the straight people are doing. So
right.
You all get to be in a group. And so now you have all of these, you have these sectors of society rising up, you know, wanting to be treated and wanting to have an experience that is equivalent to that of straight white men, right? And unfortunately, because straight white men have established a structure that makes it very difficult to wrangle power from them, what you ultimately then see is infighting. So suddenly, you know, there's infighting amongst white women. There's infighting amongst black people. There's infighting amongst the LGBTQ. You know, I'm trans. I'm gay. I'm pansexual. I'm a lesbian. I'm, you know, and all of these people need different things. And so, like, the black people are like, hey, we haven't gotten all the rights that we were trying to get yet, but now you guys shifted to the gays. And the gays are like, well, we weren't getting anything. Y'all just been ignoring us for the last 50 years. And white women are like, we've been here for 100 years, and they still haven't given us anything. And the white men sit back and eat popcorn. So it's just kind of like the idea. This is an old, and I'm going to mess this up, but you'll get it. But there is a sort of an anecdote about, I think it was the Egyptians, you know, lording over, you know, the people who had been enslaved, and somebody saying to the Pharaoh, why don't we, you know, take all of these people and put them all in, you know, a black suit so we know, you know, who all the slaves are. And the guy's like, no, don't do that. Because if you show them how many of them there actually are, then they'll realize that there's fewer of us, and that's when we're going to have a problem. So it's better to have all of these segmented groups feeling as if they have some sort of separation from other people who are at the fringes of this larger experience. They don't want us to identify. Now I sound like DJ Khaled. They don't want you to identify with the gay guy. They don't want you to identify with the white woman. They don't want you to identify, because if you do, then you realize, oh, wait a minute, there's you know, there's 60 million of us and only 14 million of them. How'd they get in charge?
Right.
So, I mean, these are all big ideas, but, you know, in terms of, you know, this film and this work, you know, to speak to connectivity, you know, intersectionality, you know, openness and understanding, and creating from that space and speaking, you know, across these sort of imagined lines of separation, I think is something that we will see more of. You know, I'm certainly glad to, you know, to have, you know, some work that exists in that space. And I mean, honestly, it's what I've always kind of done. you're talking about the idea of comedy versus, you know, drama here, and the reality is
right. Your background is comedy, and this film was the opposite, really. But yeah, you're about to say the reality is.
Yeah, it's just, well, you know, drama is a comedy without the jokes. like literally, that, you know, why do you think that guy was able to take the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and turn it into, you know, I don't know if you saw it, but a young kid took he made a short out of and turned the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air into a drama, and apparently they've decided to make it, and they're going to put it on HBO or something like that. But it's like, yeah, if you take everything about that show and strip away all of the jokes and just deal with the reality, suddenly you have a drama on your hands. And that's, you know, in things that are based in reality, you know, that tends to be the case. Strip away the jokes, and now you got people who are really having huge problems with one another, you know, that are having major conflicts, serious misunderstandings, you know, and you know, how do we actually go about fixing this? Comedy is a release valve, you know. That's identifying that there's a problem that exists, recognizing some kind of frustration or misunderstanding about it, then allowing yourself to laugh at the fact that you have no idea what to do. Drama right. is trying to fix it.
That's so interesting. That's a great way to.
Yeah, I mean, literally, it's like, it's one thing to write a cartoon about the president being, you know, a goofball of some sort or another and go, man, he sure is a goofball. That's crazy. That's hilarious. It's another thing entirely to go, we got to get this guy out of office. How do we do that? I'm not sure.
Can you do those both at once? Is it possible for them to be both at once, or does comedy not allow that to happen on its own?
Yes, I think, you know, when the comedy ends, that's when the drama begins. So if you are able to bring a level of attention to something by being funny, and then everybody can acknowledge that the thing exists. So that's actually a very it's a very sophisticated way of getting people to recognize that a thing is real. Right, we all understand. It's, you know, I mean, this is off the farm a little bit, but it's like it's jokes about men not being able to give women orgasms. When all the women laugh, now we know that that's real, right? So then the next step is, okay, what do we do about this? Now that's where the problems start, because this is going to require a fundamental change on the part of all of the men who are not doing whatever they need to do to keep their partners satisfied. And then now they're being challenged. They're being challenged. Now they got to deal with issues of inadequacy, you know, just all kinds of stuff. I mean, I'm making a laundry list here. So that's when you know, boots on the ground, when you start trying to make a real change in society, you know, you can have humor in attempting to make that change, but the default is toward the seriousness. We actually have to do something. You've seen it with Dave Chappelle. He's done two or three pieces now recently where he's been using his platform as a renowned and legendary stand-up comic to come on video and say things that aren't funny at all. He's done two or three pieces that just don't have any jokes in them at all. And he's just like, hey, this is a problem that I'm having, but I got your attention because I'm funny.
It's just so fascinating what he's doing. That is interesting. There's so many ways to use that. Well, Ali, it's been wonderful talking to you about this. Before I ask you the last question about what you're reading, is there anything else you want to mention? There'll be links in here to the film and other things, but is there anything you want to plug or mention at the end that I haven't asked you about yet?
Well, you know, I'm a pretty avid photographer, so you know, that's a space that I'm working in. If anybody went to my Instagram, they'll notice right now that there are no posts because I'm in a one man war with Instagram right now. So I keep my profile, but I rarely put anything up there. But there's a link to my photography website, and I like people to look at my photographs, so that's fun.
Okay, I feel like there's one other question I should have asked, which was a little bit about our exchange before that. But you know, this is a large audience for this. There's a lot of different people listening to this, but for those. Let's say young people of color, men, women, queer, they may be thinking, you know, I'd love to make a film like that. I'd love to do something like that. This may be a big question, but I'd love to just say, ask you, what would you say to get them going? Because part of the trick to all of this, which you touched on, is funding, of course, raising money for the film, funding the film. Like I said, if you had a dollar from everybody who laughed a million times, that would be it. If this isn't too big a question, can you speak to that audience who may think, God, I'd love to do something like Ali is doing. I have an idea like that, but where would I get funding? How would I start? How would they start? Yeah.
All right. So,
I mean, I'm trying to be a little focused by talking about the funding because that's such a difficult aspect of it. Yeah.
So, you know, I'll start with the funding and I'll say this. Because of the technology that we have available now, you know, if you have a phone, you can make a movie. It's been done. So, you know, when you talk about funding, you know, I don't know what's a great iPhone or a Samsung or whatever it costs. You know, a good one's going to cost you $500-$600. An amazing one will cost $1,000. So that's the cover charge to get into the world of being able to start creating content. Then after that, your barriers are your ingenuity, your creativity, and your relationships. Because if you know actors, or if you know writers, or if you know people who make music, then, you know, if you've got a great idea and you can convince them to go on a ride with you and try to make something, then that's the first hurdle that you have to get over. The other thing that is new is that, you know, because we have platforms for distribution and dissemination, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that you're going to upload to YouTube and get 1,000, you know, hits or 1,000,000 hits or whatever it is, but there is a record of your work in the space, like this kid that did the Fresh Prince thing. I don't know where he got the money from, but I do know when he finished, he put his thing up on the web, and now he's working with Will Smith because he had a great idea and he used his meager resources to do it. He couldn't make a whole movie, but he made a trailer. So that's part of his ingenuity. That's part of his creativity. So, you know, there was a time when, you know, you had to go get an actual film camera, and then you had to go get the film developed and all of these things. That's not the case now. So the bar of entry is lower, but the standards remain the same. So you got, you know, a lot more people have access, but, you know, there's still only a top 10, you know, in movies or records or TV shows. They didn't increase it to, here's the top 1,000 TV shows. They don't do that. They're still the top 10, even though there's a million more people in here making stuff. So just in terms of that hurdle, you know, you might, you know, I hope you have some good relationships. You might be able to borrow $100 from 10 people. You know, you might be able to, you know, use your unblemished credit record to go take out that ATM, you know, $2,500 and hope for the best and pay it back in $40 installments. You know, it's tough getting into show business. But what you have now also is you have the internet and everything from financing to books to places to show your work to communities that you can network with to get your work made. You know, it's a Google away. You get online and you ask some questions and you know, you can do things now that you weren't able to do before. And I would even say, you know, I keep a small amount of gear around myself to shoot things just to be doing something, you know? Get a camera, I'll go shoot a video, you know, of some young artist or something, just to do something, just to see if I can play in those waters. They want to play in these waters, and, you know, you just got to go out and try something. And technology allows for that. The level of communication that we have allows for that. And so the barrier now is, you know, what's the strength of your idea and the quality of your relationships? If you can, you know, really, you know, focus on those two things, then, you know, you can get to the resources, I think, that you need in order to make something. And then you have to submit it to the audience, and, you know, the audience will tell you whether or not they think it's good.
Ali, thank you for that. That was a very concise way to answer a pretty big question. I'm glad we got to that. And the last question, what are you reading at the moment?
Well, what I just finished reading was a book by Teju Cole, Nigerian writer, photographer. He has a book called Open City. It's fiction about a young doctor's experiences, you know, in New York City. But what I just started reading is Promised Land by Obama. So I'm interested to kind of make my way through that. I'm only like on page 30 or something, and it's like 8,000 pages, I think. So, you know, it might take me a minute.
Ali, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time and your work.
Well, thank you for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.